All right, thank you for that. You know, that was the last of our winter meals. Again, it doesn't seem like spring is here, but maybe by Sunday it will. Or if we all go back to Atlanta with the Taylors, it would be warm down there with the two choices we have, or be patient for warm weather to come. But appreciate all the work this winter and all the men and ladies who brought in meals and different things like this, an opportunity to meet our guests and different things. Now, this week, we go back to our normal schedule of you either go out and grab a bite to eat, bring a bite to eat, go home, and then come back, and we won't have the full luncheon each and every day from this point forth until at least once a month. And knowing me, it'll be probably twice a month this summer because I enjoy doing it. We got some good things planned, and so we may just surprise you with one every once in a while, as well as the last of every month. All right, I want to get to right into the lesson. The Taylors have just been so gracious to stay with us again, fellowship with us. They've got a meetings at, 6 o'clock? And he did it on his GPS, I'm sure, and found out that he could stay a little longer with us. But you're all packed up and ready to go, though, right? Okay, so afterward, they'll be heading out, be in prayer for them as they go down for another church for meetings, and then as he continues to find churches. And I'm assured that they'll be on their way to Chile in June of 23. I'm assured of that. And because their support's going to go up very quickly once, especially once they start, can free up to go full time. When's school get done for you? Are you counting the days? You're a typical teacher, aren't you? My daughter, probably, how many days, Nancy? Oh, really? Okay, praise the Lord. They're heading down to Florida for about 4 or 5 days, right? To be with the kids down there at Pensacola. And so they'll have a great time there. And they're leaving. You're going over on Thursday night. And then flying out on Friday from Flint, Bishop International Airport. Is it international? Is it? Okay. Oh, yeah. Josh, you know, you've been out of that one many times, probably. All right. Hosea, if you take your Bible. So I want to get right into the lesson this morning and be done. I'm not as disciplined to be done on time as what Joe was. But wait till you've been preaching for about 30 years. Trust me, you'll never be done on time. And we're covering the book of Hosea. This is the first lesson in Hosea. And let me get my notes all organized here so we can run through these things, different things. But Hosea is not the first book we covered of the minor prophets. But it's the first that comes in order, the biblical order, Hosea, Joel, and Amos. But on purpose, I started with the book of Joel and then went to the book of Amos. Now we're going back to the book of Hosea, and you say, in order, and again, there were books written before Hosea was written, so Hosea wasn't the first of the books written. But the reason I did that is so you could see the idea, have an idea of how Israel is. Because Amos pretty much sums it up. God's bringing judgment down upon them. Why? Well, they had religion, but they had no relationship. They had the false temples that they worshipped in and had the golden calves in there. And everything they did, they turned the feasts into festivals. They were wicked. They treated the poor wrong. They were just not, Israel was down the tubes. And so he gave 5 visions. And in those 5 visions, he told them about God's judgment upon Israel because they were so wicked. And there was not even hope of return at that point because the judgments all brought the judgment that was coming. It wasn't turned, but he did give hope to the individual. So I wanted you to see the state of Israel in the book of Amos and the book of Joel even. Israel was corrupt. Israel was wicked. That helps you to see where Israel was in Joel and Amos to understand what God asks Hosea to do in chapter 1. This is quite amazing. This is one of those stories, like I told you in Sunday school, the unjust steward who cheated his boss, his master, and God commended him, not for cheating, but commended him for preparing for his retirement more so than what Christians do for eternity. But it's an unusual story because God doesn't come down on the guy. He commends him. And so that's an unusual parable to me, but what God asked from Hosea to me is very unusual. And so today we'll just, by way of introduction, begin to understand chapter one. I don't think I'll get through chapter one, but I want you to understand it so you can see where God is coming from, because he's painting a picture for Israel that Israel is wicked. And so I wanted you to see from Joel and Amos how wicked Israel was and why God's judgment was coming. But he did this to Hosea and asked him to do something that was quite amazing. And it was something that as you read this story, it honestly used to boggle my mind until I researched it out. So let's start with verse 1. The word of the Lord that came unto Hosea in the days of Uzziah and Jotham and Ahaz and Hezekiah, the kings of Judah, in the days of Jeroboam, that's Jeroboam the second, the same one that was there in Amos, the sons of Joash, king of Israel, the beginning of the word of the Lord by Hosea. And the Lord said to Hosea, and here it is, go take unto thee a wife of whoredoms and a children and children of whoredoms, for the land hath committed great whoredom departing from the Lord. And he went and took Gomer, and she conceived and bare him a son. He told her to go marry a person who was going to become a harlot. She was going to cheat on him. He said, go marry her. What a request. To go marry somebody who's going to cheat on me and commit adultery on me and go away from me. And my children are going to be the sons and daughter of a whoredom. That's what God's requesting out of Hosea. Why would God request such a thing out of a man? Well, that's what we'll cover today. For this prophecy of Hosea comes first in the biblical order of the minor prophets, Hosea, Joel, Amos. It's the first of the minor prophets, and rightfully so. But it's not the first of the 12 to be written or spoken. But I think it's first in regards to its message, because you've never probably looked at it this way, and neither did I until I studied this out. But this passage is being what people have called the second greatest love story in the Bible. That's amazing to me. The second greatest. Now, what was the first greatest love story? The cross of Calvary, what Steve sang about this morning. That was the first and greatest love story. No doubt, in Christianity, the greatest story in the Bible is the life and suffering and the death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and he came to this earth to die. Listen, Steve was right when he said Jesus Christ came to this earth to die for you because he loved you, but that's not the main reason he came and did it. You know why he did it? Because it was his Father's will. First, obedience to the Father, and then obedience to man. Fits the very message Joe preached this morning. He came because it was his Father's will. Now, he died because he loved us, but even if he didn't love us, he still would have done it. You know why? Because it was his Father's will. That's the greatest love story. And it shows the real love of Jesus Christ, that he did it. He wanted to obey his Father, but in the process, he loved us so much that he died on the cross for us. That's the greatest love story, but many people say this is the second greatest. Now, you probably have never heard this story. He goes to marry a woman of whoredom. She'll go into adultery. And I believe two of the children she had weren't even Hosea's children. And yet, catch the whole story. Catch the reasoning behind this story. You see, the story of Hosea is second precisely because of its anticipation in the form of Christ's story. Hosea was a preacher, we read that. And he was during the reigns of four successive kings, Judah, Uzziah, Jotham, and Ahaz. And they were kings. Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, the kings of Judah, and Hezekiah, they were the southern kingdom. And during Rehoboam the second, the son of Joash, the king of Israel, or the northern kingdom. And we know that Jeroboam the second had the greatest success of any king up to that point. And he restored it almost back to the days of David and Solomon, when David conquered all the land and then Solomon maintained that during his reign. And it was Israel was at its height. He gained a lot of that back. Matter of fact, more than any other king before him or after him since David and Solomon. So he had a very successful, but it wasn't God honoring. This was man. This was the northern kingdom doing the work, not the blessing of God. And so when he served, because it was four kings, his ministry probably lasted for 60 to 70 years, one of the longest ministries that any prophet had. We are told nothing about Hosea's life except who he was to marry, Gomer, a woman out of whoredoms. And again, the lesson of this story unfolds for us some wonderful, wonderful truths from the Word of God. Every prophet's message, in order to be properly understood, must be studied against the background of its times. Hosea lived in a time of outward prosperity. That was Jeroboam II. We learned that from Amos. And he recovered Israel, large sphere, larger than any time since Solomon. And you'd find that in 2 Kings 14:25. He restored the coast of Israel from the entering of Hamath unto the sea of the plain, according to the word of the Lord of Israel, which he spake by the hand of the servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet. Okay, so we know he was very successful. He wasn't a godly king. There were no godly kings in the northern kingdom that did right in the sight of the Lord, but he had material blessing, and Israel became at its ultimate height to what it was in the past. Yet in spite of all that prospering, the people substituted outward forms of inward reality, as we covered in the book of Amos. They were committing all manners of sin. They were in great moral and spiritual decline. It would seem that no one, that on one occasion, no doubt early in his life, God came to Hosea to ask him to do a very, very difficult thing. This was a difficult thing. He said, Hosea, I want you to marry a woman who's going to prove unfaithful to you, but to whom, nevertheless, you're going to be faithful. You're going to remain faithful to her. What a request. Boy, if before I married my wife, she came to me or somebody came to me and said, you know she's going to cheat on you and go into whoredom, I would have, honestly, I wouldn't have married her. But that's what God asked Hosea to do. And he said, not only will she commit adultery and cheat on you, I want you to remain faithful to her. What a request. You will love her, but she will disgrace your love. And you're going to see that in chapter 2, where she did disgrace his love. I am asking you to do this, God said, because I want you to present a lesson to Israel by your marriage. It's going to be symbolic. It's going to become an object lesson. You're going to play the part of God. This woman you marry is going to play the part of my people. The reason she's going to run away and be unfaithful is that this is the way the people of Israel act in their spiritual marriage with God that I have established with them through Abraham. But you're going to remain faithful because I am faithful to the children of Israel, even though she dishonors my name. The word Hosea means salvation. He lived in the time of Isaiah, just so you put it into perspective. Isaiah was his contemporary, as well as he worked with Judah. He went to the nation of Judah, where Amos was his contemporary, and he went to the northern kingdom of Israel. But he worked with those just to give you the time frame. It was these three prophets, how we can learn and know the characters of the characteristics of this age. So the Bible doesn't say and go into details why. He just says Gomer is going to represent Israel because they were the adulteress. They played whoredoms with me. And you're going to be a symbolic of me who loves them even through that. And again, that's why we can read the book of Isaiah, we can read the book of Amos, and know exactly the details of where Israel was. Again, to many of this period, it appeared to be good because Jeroboam had such great success. But it was even in the age of luxurious materialism and apparent religious devotion and activity and freedom, even an apparent national security in which politics and law and religion all seemed to play in the favor of the people's hands. Yet as we read Isaiah and Amos, it shows us these were probably some of the worst times of Israel because the people's hearts were empty. Religion was shallow and corruption was rampant on every hand. Hosea's cry is that the people had been unfaithful to God, just as his adulterous wife is going to become unfaithful to her husband. God had blessed his people and prospered them materially and spiritually, but they began to live in pleasure. They abandoned hard work and morality and integrity in order to live for themselves. And as a side note, apart from the fact of the story of Hosea's marriage is told as a real story, and this really happened, it rings true in our lives today that sometimes, and listen to this very carefully, sometimes God leads his children into situations that are parallel to this one. God may ask you to do something that you have no idea why God asked you to do that. You may go through a job situation that you have no idea. You believe God has led you. You believe God is in it, but you have no idea why God would do this to you. God would give you this job and then maybe take away your job and you just have great financial difficulties. Or maybe it's health. Or maybe, you know, God told us to replenish the earth and you have children and they really don't want anything to do with God. Sometimes we follow God's plan or what we believe God's plan is for our life, and it's not always one of perfectness. That's what I'm trying to show you. He asked a Hosea to do something here that was incredibly different. I'm going to give you a woman and you're going to marry her and she's going to cheat on you. And you're going to love her in spite of it. And she's going to treat your love like trash. But you're going to continue to love her. What a request for God to make upon somebody. But again, in a unique way, I think God sometimes may do that to us. And he puts you as a Christian into some unique circumstances. But why did he have Hosea do this? It was to demonstrate so that people could see a visual illustration that God is a God of love. No matter how you act, what you do. And I could tell you till I'm blue in the face. But if you could see it lived out. And I think that's the idea for today. That God may put you through something that you can't even imagine why God is doing this to you. But it's to show people the love of God in living action. It's a little bit of what Pastor Taylor preached this morning. Love God with all your heart and love others as you love yourself. But you can sometimes give them the gospel and preach them till you're blue in the face until they see the love of God that's demonstrated in your life through a trial, through a testing that God has put you through. Again, if a Christian does not appear to be happy or successful, there are scores of people who are ready to work with him and to sit down and help them. But sometimes this can be shallow thinking. For God doesn't always lead people in the ways that would naturally regard them as happy and filled with success. God sometimes allows tragedies to slip into our lives. This does not mean that we're out of the will. When you married that husband or wife or took that job or made that commitment or raised that child, God may simply be using you to give a chance to show the love and the character of Christ in your own situation. We may be able to learn something from God's love through this difficulty. That's what this purpose is, so Israel can see in demonstration the love of God, that no matter what we do to God or how we turn our backs upon God, how we cheat upon God, God loves us. I know you hear that. And Israel heard that through the prophets. But God was given an illustration in a unique way through Hosea, symbolic to show them that God will never turn his back upon his people. And you say, but God did. No. Oh, God put him on a shelf. God let Assyria come in and wipe out 9/10 of the northern kingdom. I understand that. But God never turned his back upon Israel. God never stopped loving Israel. And that's why the promises will, before you finish this book, you'll see that the promises that he gave in chapter 2 fulfill exactly the love of God. So let's take a look at this. So in the beginning of the story, God tells him to go marry, and then he begins to have children. And these were named to suggest what would happen to Israel in the result of her unfaithfulness. No doubt in my mind, I think, and you could disagree with me on this, it's not doctrine, but in my mind as I studied this out, Hosea married a woman. I think she was pure. I don't think she came from a line of whoredom and cheating and playing the field. I think she was a pretty typical, now, maybe she had that in her mind and God knew it. Maybe that was in her heart and God knows the heart of people. But I think when they got married, I think she was a decent woman. And he married Gomer. And again, at that time, knowing the outcome of God's prediction. I think Hosea and Gomer even lived together probably a number of years, and they were happily married. In any case, during the early period, three children were born into the family, a son and a daughter and another son. Each was born where God intervened to give the children symbolic names. And so when the first son was born, God named him Jezreel. Jezreel has a couple meanings, but the meaning that we want to look at here at the beginning of this means scattered. That's the idea in the context of the passage. Again, in verse 4, and the Lord said unto him, call his name Jezreel. For yet a little while I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu, and will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. And it shall come to pass in that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. So he said, you're gonna have a child. And I believe this was his, because it says it was born and bare him a son. So I think this first child was born to Gomer and Hosea, and it was both their child. But he did obeyed God, and he called his name Jezreel. When the first son was born, Jezreel means scattered. It was a word of judgment. It was a word of judgment and God revealing that he would soon scatter Israel throughout the world. And that's exactly what happened because of her unfaithfulness. There were two areas in which this prophecy applies. First, in the scattering, first in the political application, it was to the house of Jehu. And you find this a little bit, but you have to do some research, because if you just read this as you read the Bible through, which is a wonderful thing to do, but you need to figure out what is he really saying here when he calls Jezreel and his name means scattered. Because the first aspect of it is the political application. In a short time, God would avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu and will bring an end of the kingdom to the house of Israel. The long and sad story of Jezreel begins way back in the days of Ahab and his wicked wife, Jezebel. That's where this is talking about. It all began with Ahab and Jezebel. And really, it begins with Naboth. Naboth, the Jezreelite, owned a vineyard near the palace of Ahab. He was murdered through the planning of Jezebel in order to dispose him of his father's heritage. And if you watch carefully, why did Naboth, and again, I really believe this is true. When Ahab wanted that vineyard, because it was right near the palace, it lined up and it would have given him more wealth and more power and more land. It was all in good shape, and he wanted that piece of land. And I think he went to Naboth and said, Naboth, I'll give you any vineyard I have. You can have it. I even think he said something like this. I'll even give you double what it's worth. He did it. I think Ahab did it, started to do it in a fair way. He wanted that land. And I'll let you pick any other land you want. You can pick any other. Or I'll give you even double what it's worth, because I don't want to cheat you on this, but I want that land because it fits exactly what I want to accomplish in my kingdom. You sit back and say, why didn't Naboth sell? It'd be very tempting to me if somebody came and said, I'll give you $450,000 for your home. I think I'd say, sold. That's a good buy. Man, that's way more, way more. That doubles my profit, more than doubles my profit. So why didn't Naboth sell? I mean, this was the king of Israel asking him for his vineyard. Why didn't he just give it to the king of Israel? Well, I you have to figure it out. I thought for sure it was a spiritual reason, and I think this is partially a spiritual reason. But if you go back to Leviticus, because Leviticus has a lot of the history, a lot of the laws, and a lot of the ideals that God sent forth for Israel. Now, the Israelites didn't follow it any longer at this point, but Naboth did. You know, it goes back to Daniel. Not a lot of people still came. But Daniel, when he went into Babylon, he purposed in his heart that he wouldn't what? Defile himself with the king's meat, because he understood God's law. Well, Naboth is that way here. He understands God's law. And the idea behind it in Leviticus chapter 25 is the land shall not be sold forever. For the land is mine. For ye are strangers and sojourners. This isn't your land. This is my land, God said. And in all the land of your possession, ye shall grant a redemption for the land. And if thy brother be waxen poor and has sold some of his possession, and if any of his kin come to redeem it, then shall he redeem it, that which his brother sold. And if a man have none to redeem it, himself be able to redeem it. Then let him count the years of the sale thereof and restore the surplus unto the man to whom he sold it, that he may return unto his possession. And if he be not able to restore it him, then that which is sold shall remain in the hand of him, though he bought it, until the year of Jubilee. And in the year of Jubilee, it shall go out, and he shall return unto his possession. You see, God gave to each one of the Jews a piece of land. And he said, this isn't your land. It's my land. But you're to keep this land. It's your land. Now, the same is true today, and you hear me talk about this all the time. All your possessions, all that you have is not yours, it's God's. He's just given you, and he wants you to take care of it for him. That's the idea here. This is your land, and this has to stay in your family. And if you ever have to sell it because you've just become dirt poor and can't afford it, you go out and work, and then when you can buy it back, the person you sold it to has to sell it back to you. In the Jewish realm, he has to sell it back to you because that is God's land and that is the land God gave him. And in the process and time, he just can't buy it back. When the year of Jubilee comes, you give the land. Don't sell it. You give the land back to him because that's not your land. It's his land and it's God's land that he's given to you. So Naboth, in his mindset, said, this isn't my land. This is God's land. But this is the inheritance he gave to me to give, to keep in my family. This is my inheritance that I have to take care of from God. And so, it's a great price you're giving me, Ahab. And there's probably some better vineyards that I could pick. But this is the vineyard that God gave to me. And I can't give it to you. Wow. It's no different than what Daniel did. He purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the king's meat. Naboth purposed in his heart that this was God's inheritance to his. This is the land he was supposed to take care of and pass down to his children and to their children. This was a land that would stay in the family for the rest of the Jewish, and from his children and their children and their children and their children and their children. And their children. So I want you to see this. It was a spiritual thing, but it was him obeying God's law. And that's when Jezebel came on the scene and said, boy. So she raised up and they made false accusations about him that he was into idolatry and he was blaspheming God. And they raised up a court and got people together and she had false witnesses and they voted right there to have him slain and killed. But not only did she kill Naboth, but she killed all of Naboth's family, the relatives that would inherit the land. Then she came to Ahab in the palace and said, the land is yours. Naboth is gone. Take it. Go possess it. You know what Ahab did? Jezebel did. But here's what you got to remember. God never forgot that. God always remembered. You know what? All those people will be forgotten. You say, boy, that wasn't fair that God allowed that to happen to Naboth. But you know what? This is thousands and thousands of years later, and I'm still preaching about Naboth. He did receive the blessing of God. He had this story written in a book that's the most popular book, the most sold book, and the most famous book in all the world. Naboth's story comes up. Maybe God didn't bless him right there, and he lost his life, and his children lost his life, but his story lives on forever. And I don't know about you, but I think that would be a good exchange. To have my life live on, to affect people 3,000 years from now if the Lord were to tarry his return, I think I'd take that. But God never forgot. Now, God never forgot. For his horrible act, God pronounced doom upon Ahab and Jezebel and their descendants. And their doom would take place in Jezreel, in the very place where Naboth was slain. The sentence upon Ahab was first executed when he fought at Ramoth-Gilead. And then the blow fell upon Jezebel and Jehoram through Jehu, the son of Joseph. God raised up Jehu as an instrument to execute God's judgment upon Ahab's house. And I took my doctrine book, and I looked it up, and it just listed some things. He was anointed by Elisha. This is Jehu, the person that would carry out God's execution. He was anointed by Elisha and ordered to execute the dynasty of Ahab, which included Joram and Jezebel as well. He rode his chariot to the valley of Jezreel, where he executed both Jehoram and Ahaziah, the sixth king of Judah, not to be confused with Azariah. He then made his way to the city of Jezreel and killed Jezebel. And after this, he demanded and received the heads of the 70 sons of Ahab who were living in the city of Samaria. He continued his blood purge by slaying even the descendants and friends of Ahab. He finally, by trickery, assembled all the priests of Baal in a large convention hall in Jezreel, where he ordered the slaughter of each priest. Then he became king and ruled for 28 years. This was all ordained by God. This is all of God's judgment. This is that Jezreel, the first child that was born. This is the prophecy that's being fulfilled. That God was going to scatter Israel, and that's exactly what he did. But he was going to bring judgment upon, he was going to use Jehu to bring judgment down upon Ahab and all his family and all the descendants. That was there. He came to the throne, but he came to the throne dastardly through dastardly crimes of blood and guiltlessness. True, his act was set forth by God, and he was commanded by God to destroy all of Ahab's siblings and everybody that was related to Ahab, and he was commanded by God. But later events showed the motivating causes in Jehu's life had been pride and ambitious. He had the wrong attitude in his heart. And so the prophet Hosea's pronouncement fit right here in where Jeroboam II, who was the king of Israel, of Jehu's house. And Jehu was slain as well because of his wrong attitude and his wrong motivation in carrying out God's plan. God would not only visit the house of Jeroboam, who's in relation to Jehu, but all of Israel with the destruction of the kingdom because of their gross departure from the Lord. It is clear that although Jehu was the instrument of God for visitation and a punishment upon deserving Ahab and Jezebel's dynasty, nevertheless, God required of him because his own heart was not right and because of his personal ambitions contrary to the mind of God. Hosea 4 warned that at the end of Jehu's dynasty and the destruction of the northern kingdom with all its military power, it would come to an end in the valley of Jezreel. That's the idea. That's the first application when he said, name him Jezreel. So you just casually read that. It doesn't mean a whole lot to you. But if you understand the meaning of what God is trying to communicate to Israel, there's a lot behind it in that name of Jezreel. And I'll just give you the second application, I'm done. The second application of prophecy to Israel is to Israel herself. Jezreel means scattered. And so since his prophesying, not long would come the fall of Samaria and the captivity of the northern kingdom in 722 BC. That's what we've been talking about in the book of Amos. Amos predicted it and said it was going to come. He never said it was the Assyrian people. He never said it was going to be in 722 BC. But that's when it did come. That's what he's saying. And Israel is going to be scattered all over the place. They're no longer become a kingdom. It wouldn't be the northern kingdom, the southern kingdom. It would be called the kingdom of Judah. They would never have kings ever to reign over them again when it's all said and done. But Israel will be scattered all over the world. That was the idea. So today, people are scattered all the way from Samaria to Los Angeles, from Nazareth to New York City. That's the idea of Jezreel. So he said, Hosea, I want you to marry a woman who will become fall into whoredoms and adultery. She's going to cheat on you. She's going to treat you like trash. But she represents Israel. But I want you to marry her and love her in spite of it because you represent my love for Israel. You're going to have a child. Matter of fact, you're going to have three children. The first one, when it's born, will be your child. You call it Jezreel. That word Jezreel is going to show the political side of it. The judgment that came down upon Jehu all the way to Jeroboam II. That's why he lost his kingdom. And it went all the way back to Ahab and Jezebel when they slew Naboth. What a story. But not only is it going to be a political, but it's going to be as well as upon Israel itself. Because Israel's going to be scattered. It wasn't until about 1948 that really Israel began, and even today they're beginning to make their way back into Jerusalem. I believe this doesn't fulfill prophecy, but I think it's setting up the fulfillment of prophecy. And they're making their way back to Jerusalem and back to Israel. Why? Because they were scattered all over this world. This book has a lot of meaning, a lot of truth to it. Weird story, a weird request. But yet within the story, you see powerful, powerful truths in this book. Hosea chapter 1. Let's pray. Father, I wish I could go all the way through. We'll do that next week. But it's such an unusual request that has been asked of Hosea. But many have called this the second greatest picture of a love story. That Hosea continued to love his wife even though she cheated on him. And had children that weren't even his children. He tried to supply for her needs and that threw back right back in his face. But he continued to love her. What a picture of the love that Jesus or God has for each one of us, for his children. So I thank you for the truth from Hosea. Thank you for the truth of Joel and Amos that lay the background to why God had this story fulfilled in the life of Hosea. Thank you for using Hosea, and thank you for him being willing to go through this to teach a powerful, powerful truth to the nation of Israel, but not only the nation of Israel, but to us. So help us to learn these lessons, not just as we close, as we always do here